Okay, how's the sound? Can everybody hear me? Excellent. Well, thank you once again for allowing me to come and speak this morning. I'm glad that that first session was over. I was a little bit anxious about doing that talk on the age of the earth, the discussions, and so thanks for being gracious with me in that. And this is more, the kind of subject I'm going to talk about this morning is more of my comfort zone, and you'll probably notice that. But just thank you so much for such a wonderful time here. We've been here for 2 days now, and the people in this part of the world are really amazing. They've been so kind and gracious to us and to our friends who visit us from Pittsburgh. And just thank you so much. It's just an amazing, amazing church, and I've only been here 2 days. And I've listened a bit about the history of this church and the reason for its founding and people desiring to want to actually use the Bible in their Sunday education classes and, you know, having a view of the scriptures and wanting to serve the Lord and follow after Christ. And we need more of that. And so I'm just delighted to and privileged to be here, to be able to come and address this congregation. And hopefully what I might have to say this morning might be of importance to us all. The title of the sermon this morning is, "To Whom Does Your Mind Belong?" And the verse of scripture this morning which we're going to build around is Romans chapter 12, verse 2. So if you have your Bibles, do open your book up to Romans chapter 12, verse 2. This is a very well-known verse, and you've probably heard a number of sermons on this verse. Comes at a significant stage in the book of Romans because we find Paul is here transitioning from where he's taught us about the gospel through Romans, through 1 through 8. Then he's taken a little bit of a detour, Romans 19, 11, and addressed some of the concerns of his Jewish brothers. And then we find the transition where he's now, having taught these things, is looking at the application section of Romans that goes from Romans 12 through to the end of the book. And so there's a big therefore there as you're going to apply. But I'm going to focus on verse 2. It says, "Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will." The primary object of this sermon this morning is to get you to consider the condition of your mind. You might wonder, what on earth does this have to do with apologetics? Apologetics is giving a defense of the faith. But for this reason, and for many others, but chiefly for its application to apologetics, is that if we have feeble minds, we're not going to do apologetics. Because apologetics requires that you start to take an interest in things that you're not only interested in, that you start to read and learn. And so if you've got feeble and facile minds and that don't want to study and learn, you're not going to do apologetics. Because it requires that we start to take an interest in things and learn. So that's the relationship between this and apologetics. But more importantly, The condition of the Christian mind applies to many other areas in the life of the Christian, not just being able to give a reason to the Jehovah's Witness, for example, who shows up at your door. And how I'm going to do this, I'm going to begin with my testimony, because really I'm just a walking example of how this is all cashed out and how God has worked in my life in this area. I was born in Zimbabwe, so it can be said that I'm really from the deep south. I make the folks in Mississippi look like they're Yankees. I was born in Zimbabwe. My mom was from that part of the world, and I'm married to a South African girl, Nell. I became a Christian when I was at boarding school, when I was about 13 years old. And then after I left high school, I went to college. And like a lot of young people, when I got to college, the wheels fell off and the terrain was derailed. And I just started going after the things that most college students do: wine, woman in song, and that kind of thing. So I started drifting away from the faith. That's one of the biggest regrets of my life. I'm sad that I lost those years, confident that I could steer this truck when I had no idea what I was doing. And so after a number of years of traveling all over the world and working all over the world, which I've had the privilege of doing, I constantly bumped into people in bars and in bars and outside of bars, and I, after listening to the wisdom of the world, eventually reached the conclusion. I thought, hang on a sec, these people are all just as sad as one another, and their stories are all as miserable as one another, and there's no hope there. And I had enough Christianity left in me to have bumped into some Christians along the way who were by no means perfect, but there was something in their life that was beautiful and constant and not mad, consumed with this madness. And I thought, I know where that comes from. I'm going back there. And so I got invited to go back to church by some friends of mine in London. And I said a couple of prayers. I had no idea what I was asking for, but that's the danger with prayer sometimes. Be careful what you ask for, because you might just get it. And I said to the Lord, would you, if I'm to come back to you, I wanted Christianity back. I wanted that peace that I'd seen in the lives of others. I was just tired of the madness. I was tired of standing in bars and, you know, having drunk conversations with fools. And I eventually said to the Lord, I said, Lord, can you give me a desire to study the Bible? Because that's why I'm going to learn a lot about you. And I want to learn stuff. And he just gave me this appetite to want to read, which wasn't particularly popular in the church I was involved in, because I wasn't involved in a very charismatic church. And I read through all their books on their shelf, the entire library, in about 6 months. And then I read Leo Tolstoy. And my life was changed. Because what I saw was there was a dimension to Christianity which these people weren't talking about. This deep, profound kind of... This book that Leo Tolstoy wrote was called The Kingdom of God is Within You. Is the book that influenced Gandhi. Gandhi's the famous Indian person who challenged the colonialism and through pacifism changed the whole country of India. And he got his ideas from a Christian man. And I was just so intrigued by that. Nobody ever told me that. And so I then had this, in addition to my reading, I had a desire to want to share the gospel. I wanted to share the gospel with anybody who walked. But I was living in London at that stage. And Europe is a very skeptical place. And I found it extremely difficult to share the gospel with people. And because I wasn't prepared to deal with their objections. I then went to Speaker's Corner in London, which is a place of public debate. And this is a place which has been around for centuries. It's where they used to have people get up on soapboxes and they would argue or talk about anything. And so at Speaker's Corner on Sundays, you have in the corner of this park, you'll sometimes have thousands of people showing up. And there will be all sorts of people who just get up on these little step ladders and just start talking about politics and economics and religion. But the chief debate that goes on at Speaker's Corner is a debate between the Christians and the Muslims. And I was trying to share the gospel with some Muslims. And the Muslims dismantled me using my own Bible. They went to Deuteronomy chapter 18 and the Gospel of John and made arguments that the Bible spoke of the coming of Muhammad, the prophet of Islam. And I had no idea what to do with that. Of course, when I tried to engage them, they proceeded to say to me, look, not only are you ignorant of your own Christian faith and your own Bible, but you know nothing of Islam. Now go away. And so there I was with a heart like Secretariat for Jesus. I had this huge desire. But I couldn't engage these people. I had no response to them. I had nothing to say to the Muslims. And so I was, after this uncomfortable encounter, I was left asking myself these two questions. Is Christianity true? And what on earth is the church teaching me on Sunday? Because here it wants me to go and speak to the Muslims, and I don't know anything about them. And that's not making for productive conversations. So I had a heart and a passion for Christ, but I found myself incapable of assembling any kind of reasonable response. And so all of my persuasiveness was to recount my own subjective experience with Jesus. And this was a challenge for me. Well, in America today, we're told that between 40 to 80% of Christians who leave the church and go off to college will lose their faith. I'm involved with a campus ministry with a literature on the table called Rasha Christi, and I work in the universities across this country. This ministry has grown in the last 3 years from 10 chapters to over 140 chapters in the United States, with interest at an additional 180. And it's been driven by Christian students on campus who are tired of being bullied on campus. And a lot of our young people leave the faith. And this attrition rate, I don't think, just falls within the universities. It's our culture is bent that way as well. And it's not just academic institutions where we see this attrition of Christians abandoning their faith. Many lay people are confronted with objections from those in society. And if we are honest with ourselves, I think that many of us have our own questions about the faith with respect to Christianity. And sometimes it is these questions which lead people to renouncing their faith. And in many instances, it is a failure to attend to these questions that begins a slow and steady erosion of the faith of a believer. And then if Christians don't abandon their faith wholesale, the other condition that we find these young people in the college is they become these very quiet Christians. And so they believe the faith, but I can maybe know that Christianity is true, but what's true for me is true for me, and what's true for you is true for you, and so I'm not going to go and peddle Christianity in front of you, because it's just what I believe. And this is what you've got going on in the minds of a lot of young people in the universities. Well, is this the sort of faith worth dying for? Would you go to the gallows over half-baked, shallow convictions about the Christian faith? Would you be prepared to die for those kinds of convictions? Well, I'm not so sure, you know. It's true for me, it's not really true for you, that kind of thing. What's this faith of the early church that one reads about in the New Testament or in church history? And sadly, this kind of Christian agnosticism, this brand of Christian agnosticism, has even gained an air of piety because people say, well, aren't you extremely arrogant in believing that you have the exclusive truth? Aren't you Christians just so arrogant that you believe that kind of thing? Now, this kind of sentiment should not surprise us, because the age in which Christianity now finds itself sees Christianity as just one other religious belief system out there on the smorgasbord of religions. You know, you can just go and pick and choose what you want from in the culture today. And this leads to a great spiritual anxiety within our culture. And so people say, well, maybe Christianity just works for you. No, it doesn't work for me. So you go and do your thing, and strum your guitars and do your little Bible study. We'll do our thing over here. So at college, students are confronted with questions that press them into giving a reason for their faith. For believing in something without any good reason is seen to be irrational. Christians are often mocked for being foolish, for we believe in an immaterial God for whom the critics declare there is no evidence. God is just a Santa Claus for adults, and hence his existence falls into the same category as that of unicorns and flying spaghetti monsters, so the critics say. There are, of course, other reasons why college students abandon the faith, and as I've mentioned, I was susceptible to that, wine and women and song. I was a college too. I know what goes on there. But one of the chief reasons is that shallow belief has no substance to it, and ultimately is not worth of any form of kind of commitment. This shallow belief is often exposed at the universities, and increasingly so even at the high schools in this country now. Shallow belief fails, for it fails to satisfy both the emotional and the intellectual aspects of the human nature. So long gone are the days when the basic assumptions of Christianity can be taken for granted, and certainly if ever there's a part of the U.S. where that's true, it's in the Northeast. Today we have been forced to deal with questions that others have regarding Christianity, and these questions are often critical of the faith. And sadly, most Christians are unable to offer any kind of reasonable response to some of the most basic objections to the Christian faith. I remember inviting people to church when I was in London, and I really wanted to share the gospel with others, but I soon realized that the Christianity that I was calling to them was a form of this dualism, in which we place people in a state of tension. We plowed their emotions in the church in the hope that this would subjugate their minds. Our worship was like, you know, lights and everything like that. It was like a big concert. We worship and sang. But we avoided these questions, you know, almost intentionally. in the hope that perhaps the emotional convictions would just overwhelm the individual and they would just set their minds aside. And so we avoided these questions like the plague. The mind back then seemed to me it was a problem for Christianity, for the mind seemed to be getting in the way. Little did I realize that our teachings on this issue were nothing short of a form of occultism. One of the things that we do at our seminaries, we study the occult. We have to read sections out of the Satanic Bible. We study the New Age's people and their influences. We study those things because we want to understand the culture and because we go and we have to have conversations with these kind of people. I remember being at Barnes & Noble in Charlotte one time, and I was talking about, I don't believe in coincidence. So I'm sitting down there reading a section out of the Satanic Bible in my folder, and the guy sitting next to me shows up, this kid with a whole bunch of little crowd, and he's dressed up with his goth stuff, and he starts talking about the Satanic Bible right next to me. And of course, all these young kids are just so enamored with this, and you know, he has this guy so confidently talking about this, and so I'm listening in on this conversation. And these kids are so enamored, it's so dangerous and dark, and I mean, it's so attractive to some of these young people. But I thought, well, I'm going to burst his bubble here. So I said, I couldn't help overhear you talking about the Satanic Bible. I said to him, what do you think of Anton LaVey? He said to me, who's Anton LaVey? I said, he's the guy who wrote the Satanic Bible. Which, of course, took away any kind of authority he now had. He didn't even know who Anton LaVey was. I said, do you know that most of the Satanic Bible has just been plagiarized by another guy, from another guy called Ragnar Redbeard, wrote this book. I forget the title of it. I said, do you realize that? And what happened is his whole persona and all of his authority just crumbled in on itself. So is it important to read the Satanic Bible sometimes? Yeah. Hey? Now, I'm not advocating that everybody go out there and do that, because sometimes we want to take that out of the way. But there needs to be somebody in our Christian culture that is studying these things, so that we can reach out to these people who are caught up in some of these worldviews. And that was just a personal example. So what happened to me is, and this is what the cults do, the cults subjugate the mind. This is what the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Watchtower Organization do. You know? They don't encourage critical thinking in their churches, and unfortunately we don't do the same in our church. That's a form of occultism. Okay, you see that in the cults. It's one of the things that you can helps you filter cults out of various ideas. So in short, my evangelism was induced to an emotional appeal in which I hoped that the emotions would proceed to override the mind and subdue those perplexing questions. And sadly, some people think that this is what faith is. Faith is has nothing to do with reason. It's this sort of blind, well, it doesn't matter what you say, I'm just going to believe it anyway. That's not biblical faith. This kind of faith says that when you're thinking about God and you reach a problem, you just inject your faith and go on your merry way. People say, isn't it foolish for finite man to expect his way to reason to God? And these people see reason, Christians see reason as opposed to God, which is rather odd given that God gave us the mind, which is doing the reasoning and by which we contemplate Him. And so many Christians, for example, are convinced that the reason why Christianity is true is because of their religious experience. And so their emotions become a test for truth. Okay? They can give no defense for why they think Christianity is reasonable outside of their own personal convictions. And they can offer no defense for the rationality of Christianity. And they see no need to do so because I have had this religious experience. And so what we need to do is just preach the gospel and love people. That's the kind of message that we have coming out of a lot of churches today. But what kind of love is it that doesn't dignify the fact that people have an intellect given to them by God? What makes you assume that God doesn't have something to say about that as well? This kind of Christian disposition is very problematic. Now, let me illustrate my point. I was in Charlotte and some Mormons came to the door to do their evangelism. And we invited them in and we start having a conversation with these Mormons and we try and track them down where we can and engage these Mormons. Here's what the Mormon faith is going to do, almost without exception. In your conversations, should they come and visit you, they're going to talk about Mormonism and the Book of Mormon and Joseph Smith and how it is that the LDS church. Joseph Smith saw all of the different denominations, and he was confused by that. And so God said, well, they're all apostate, and so you're going to become the true denomination, and you need to come and follow me. This kind of thing. But when you really get into a discussion with them, this is what the Mormons will do. This is the ace in their deck. They will say this: if you want to know that this is true, then you need to pray to God, and when you feel a burning in your bosom, then you will know that it's true. Of course, the challenge to that is, I said to him, I said, look, so you're saying there's some kind of religious experience that you have that confirms that it's true? I said to him, but I pray to God, and I have a religious conviction that this is true. Yet you think I'm deceived, and I think you're deceived. I said further, I said, the Muslims would tell you that when they go on the Hajj to Mecca, and they're praying with millions and millions and millions of other Muslims, that they have this very vibrant religious experience. You think they're deceived? Everybody is, a lot of people are having religious experiences, religious subjective experiences. And that's certainly legitimate and a part of the Christian faith, but is that all we have to stake our claim on? No. I said to him, you're going to need to appeal to something to me outside of that subjective experience to try and convince me that Mormonism is true. So he has one basic question you can ask a Muslim. The Book of Mormon speaks of these massive civilizations existing here in North America, which were involved in these epic battles. Show me one brick, one structure that they found, telling us that these people even existed. There's nothing. Is that not a reasonable question to be asking them? Well, what about the Bible? Well, go to the Middle East. It's like one big archaeological dig. And a lot of that stuff is digging up what? Stuff relating to biblical cities and people that the Bible mentions and individuals. It's all over the place. So you can see the difficulty here is that if Christianity is true, it's not just true because I have a Christian religious experience. It's true also independent of my own subjective experience. And so unfortunately, a lot of our evangelism has been reduced to the same kind of things that the Mormons do. Where we give our testimony, which we need to be able to do and do that persuasively, but it doesn't end there. Because God has given us a lot more to testify about Him than just Simon Brace's religious experience. Of course, one of the difficulties, like I said, is how do you adjudicate between my experience and the Mormon? And this is what I made out to him. And they can't get beyond that. The primary reason for this belief, which is the default position of most people today, is that truth is no longer held to be absolute. Instead of that, people now have got this view of truth, which is affecting why they think like this. They think the truth is relative. The truth is no longer one certain thing for all people, regardless of their original culture. And so you hear this, what's true for you is true for you, and what's true for me is true for me. Who's heard that? Yeah, that's what you get. That's what you're going to get in the culture from so many people. This is the slogan of the day. But truth by its very definition is absolute. It is in fact, it's impossible to deny that absolute truth exists. The claim that the truth is relative is self-defeating. What does this mean? Well, suppose I said this: I cannot speak a word of English. What's wrong with that statement? What did I just do? I spoke a word of English. It's a self-defeating statement. There is no truth. What's wrong with that statement? Is that true? This is passed off as the philosophy of the day. Well, what's true for you is true for you, and what's true for me is true for me. Well, what if what's true for me is that that statement is not true for me? Is that true? Can you see how this is just philosophical nonsense, passed off as being intellectually sophisticated? This is the philosophy which governs your universities, by the way. Believe it or not. It's unbelievable. This is just nonsense. Truth is absolute. Interestingly, listen to what Scripture says in 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 8. For we cannot do anything against the truth, but only for the truth. We don't make up truth. We discover truth. Those who fail to acknowledge the absolute nature of truth end up in all sorts of absurdities. Okay, let me just give you a few examples. Suppose my wife was pregnant, okay? Much to my horror, because I've planned a fishing trip the month she's going to give birth. And I go there and I think, man, the guys, we've got this whole thing, the drummer running on the coast of Carolina. I've got to be there. And my wife says, darling, you've got to get ready. I'm feeling like I'm going to fall over. And this child is, you know, 15-pound baby. I'm dying. We've got to make all these plans. And I'm like, well, my darling, I can't make it. You know, but I'm pregnant. Well, that's just true for you. Now, what do you think she's going to say? Well, suppose I go to the bank and I say, hey, look, man, I've got to buy this stuff now. I need to withdraw $50,000 in my account. Mr. Brace, but you only have $5 in your account. Well, that's just true for you. Or suppose I go to the doctor and he says, you know, Simon, you've got stage 4 cancer. We need to put you in the room now. You're not going home. You need to get in that room. We need to put these chemicals in you. Well, that's just true for you. Can you see how this philosophy waxes as being sophisticated, but yet in real life, it's just nonsense? So when we undermine this notion that truth is an absolute, it leads to all sorts of bizarre nonsense and stupidity, which is rampant throughout the American culture. And it's not just here, it's everywhere. Sadly, the vast majority of Christians would panic if you asked them to give a definition of truth. Yet we are meant to be what? Ambassadors who carry truth to people. So the question is, what is truth? Truth is that which corresponds with reality. Remember that. Because you're meant to be a bearer of truth. And if you can't even define what it is that truth is, what exactly are you sharing with people? What's behind this nonsense is a philosophy called postmodernism. And this philosophy dominates the colleges today. This view that truth is relative. And it's nonsense. I'm certainly more comfortable embarking on a flight knowing that the pilot has some convictions about the absolute nature of gravity. That it is true for me as well that there is enough fuel to cross the Atlantic and that flying at 50 feet above the ground is dangerous not just for the pilot but for me. And so we live our lives on the assumption that truth is absolute, that things correspond with reality. What many Christians believe is that if you buy into postmodernism, okay, it then saves Christianity because it means that critics can't critique us. So I can have my faith. Why? Because it's true for me. What's true for me is true for me. And so you can't critique me because it's true for me. So it's amazing. I've met people who think that postmodernism has done Christianity a favor. Even if I wasn't a Christian, that postmodern philosophy is mentally constipated. It's bad philosophy. It ought to be rejected on philosophical grounds. So pertaining to the condition of the Christian mind, two things need to be addressed. What is the nature of truth? And is there a division between faith and reason? And we've dealt to some extent with the nature of truth. And you've seen, I've talked a bit about that. But now I want to talk about the relationship between faith and reason. Now, it is with the faculties of your reason or your mind that you apprehend and you understand truth. So if we renounce reason or we make light of it, many in the church today, declaring reason to be in opposition to faith, then we abandon or we lose the tool within us that goes and fetches truth, our intellect, our minds. Faith, we've often been told, is a sort of blind faith, this noble leap that abandons reason. And people exalt this view of faith. That's not the biblical view of faith. God has given us more than enough reason to believe that He exists. He's given us 66 books, a library, and of the creation, screaming something. What? That there's something else that explains this universe. And we all know this. All people know this, regardless of their religion. So concerning the relationship between faith and reason, we need to begin understanding something about human nature. There are two significant aspects to human nature. We are composed of intellect and emotions, or heart and mind. And one reason for the failure of the churches today is that many Christian leaders fail to address both dimensions of the individual, to address both your emotions and your mind. And so the church often devotes its time to plowing people's emotions without relating it to the nature of truth and how this applies to reality. Rarely, if ever, do I come across churches who are devoted in their attention to the development of the Christian mind, which is what Paul is talking about in Romans. Strange enough, in this transition, what does he focus on? Your intellect. That's a very interesting point that Paul is doing in the book of Romans, a very significant book in the New Testament. Even sort of the starched, sort of more legalistic churches who are sometimes devoted to the Word, that sometimes doesn't follow from that that they necessarily are attending to the Christian mind. They might have good sound doctrine, in which they're sort of believing, but they're not believing it with any kind of thoughtful, rational processing of their minds. Why do we all cringe when we hear fundamentalist characters, Christian fundamentalists, speaking in the culture? You know, they can tell us good doctrine, some of these fundamentalist guys here in America. But they're bizarre to me. Because the moment they get into the public arena and they start talking about Christianity, they sound like goons. They can tell you about sin and salvation and they're good churchmen. But when it gets to talking about how Christianity might speak to all these other aspects of life, which it does because it all belongs to God, they just make idiots of themselves, and it's not persuasive in the slightest. And there's a vast distinction between being called a fool and actually being one. What is a fool? A fool is somebody who's ignorant. We may be called fools for Christ, but you reserve the right to not be foolish by removing yourself from ignorance, by employing your mind to serve God, employing your mind for the glory of Christ. So the solution to the problem is we have to appeal to both the heart and the mind. And if Christian leaders are failing to address both aspects, they are doing their fellow brothers and sisters in the church a disservice. Denying the heart or mind or placing priority of one above the other is contrary to the greatest commandment of God, which explicitly declares that we are to give both our hearts and our minds unto Him. Just like the guy in worship says, we love you, we love God with everything, with our hearts and our minds. God does not ask you to abandon reason, nor does He expect you to rid yourself of your emotions. The greatest commandment in Matthew 22:37 declares, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all of your mind. I stress this very important point, affirmed in the greatest commandment, that both the emotions and the passions are critical to the religious experience of the Christian, but that the exercises of the Christian mind towards God is as much a part of that experience, that subjective experience and passion that we feel to Christ, feel towards Christ. So our relationship with Jesus is personal, but it's also true and reasonable. For far too long, the church has been guilty of neglecting the mind, and as a result, this has left many Christians frustrated, dissatisfied, and unfortunately, deeply ignorant. Even sadder is the fact that pastors then expect their congregations to go out and witness to people when they are in this condition. It is no wonder that so many people are terrified of evangelism. In my experience, most lay people desire to be able to share the gospel and reach out to others. But they are hamstrung because no one has taken the time to teach them about the reasonableness of the Christian faith. How can we have any confidence in our witness if we do not have something reasonable to say to people? And this is because of the neglect of the Christian mind. So this has to be understood. God not only desires your heart, He desires your mind. God gives you good reason to believe in Him. God wants you to be confident in your witness. You have good reason to believe that God exists, and that what God claims for you is not just true for you, but it's true for all men. Can we prove that God exists? Well, I can't cut a piece of God off and say, oh, there He is. There's His left toe. Because He's a transcendent being. He's an immaterial being. But that doesn't mean we can't prove. Because it demands, well, what you... What do you mean by proof? Can I give you an argument? Premise one, premise two, conclusion? Certainly, there's many great, powerful, persuasive arguments for the existence of God. Paul is referring to this in Romans chapter 1. He says what? That we can know something about the nature of God from what? The things that have been made. The universe does not have the power to explain itself. Anything which comes into existence demands that something explain that where it came from. Has this Bible always existed? No, somebody wrote it, published it, printed it. What about this building? Has this building always been here? No, it came into existence. Well, you just take the same reasoning and apply it to reality. Physical things come into existence. They get their existence from something else. And whatever explains the kinds of things in this world has to have a different kind of nature. It would need to be what? Immaterial. Because if it was material, we've just got an infinite regress of material things. It would need to be immensely powerful. Because whatever put the universe into existence would demand huge power. And it would have to be eternal. Because time and space come into existence. Well, those are three of the classical attributes of God. And so when we go to, these kids go onto college campuses and you start speaking to your supposed wise secular friends who think that they've understood it all, you start to ask them these kinds of questions. How on earth can the universe explain its own existence? How can something be prior to itself? That's metaphysically impossible. It's like saying the reason why this Bible exists is because the Bible explains how this Bible came into. That's nonsense. It doesn't make any sense. So we have very compelling arguments we can make concerning the existence of God. Listen to the words of Paul in his defense before Agrippa in Acts chapter 26, verses 25 and 26. Paul is giving his defense. He's been put in jail and he's on trial. He's having to give a defense of himself. And Festus and Agrippa are listening to his thing. And then listen very carefully what it says in Scripture. Okay? Because Festus gets irate. It says, and accuses Paul of being insane. He says, all this teaching is driving you nuts. Listen to what Paul says. He says, I am not insane, most excellent Festus, Paul replied. What I am saying is what? True and reasonable. And then he says, the king is familiar with these things and I can speak freely to him. I am convinced that none of this has escaped his notice because it was not done in a corner. And what is he speaking of there? He's speaking of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. He's appealing to historic evidence. And if you go to the 1 Corinthians chapter 15, which is the great chapter on the resurrection, what do we find there? That we know that there were more than 500 eyewitnesses to the death and resurrection of Jesus. This was a public event. Paul is saying, if you don't believe me, then go down there and ask these people whether this actually happened or not. He's appealing to evidence. He's not saying, well, God's got a wonderful plan for your life. That might be true. And certainly it is true if people would bend their knee to Christ. And it depends what you mean by wonderful. Because if suffering for Christ is what you mean by wonderful, well, then you're going to have to qualify that. Because Christianity is difficult, if not impossible, without the Holy Spirit. So make sure you let people know that in the gospel. But Paul here is saying these things are true and reasonable. Suppose I'm living in Zimbabwe and some guy shows up from America and says, you know, a couple of years ago, there were these guys who jumped on these jetliners and they flew these planes into these buildings. I go, what are you talking about? That's crazy. He says, no, and these huge big buildings in New York came crashing down. Thousands of people died. I go, that sounds like a bit of a pork pie there. You know? Well, you know, what about, you know, I've got this, look at this here, look at this picture here, you see these buildings? Yeah, well, you know, you can do all sorts of crazy things with videos, and that's probably came off some Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. You know? How can I believe that? So he says, okay, I'm going to put you in an airplane. I'm going to fly you to New York. We're going to go there. Well, I'm going to arrive in New York, and I'm going to walk down the street, and as I walk down that island, down to the bottom end, who might I bump into? An eyewitness. Notice how often the New Testament talks about what? We were eyewitnesses to His Majesty. Christianity is true and reasonable because it happened in history in real time. It's not just true because I've felt something powerful and personal in my own life. And if Jesus Christ was crucified and resurrected, then whether or not the atheist chooses to believe in it or not, it's still true for him. This is what we've got going on. So God is not just the Santa Claus for grown-ups. The universe declares the glory of God. And so when these atheists say this kind of thing, I said, yeah, I've got no reason to believe in Santa Claus because I have no evidence to believe that he exists. But I have more than enough evidence to believe that God exists and that Jesus Christ is who he claimed to be. Where does this fear start from within the church? The fear became a part of the church when the church removes itself from the academic arena and out of the arena of ideas. It is out of the colleges and the universities that the ideas of the day, which are often anti-Christian, are spawned and protected and nurtured and absorbed into the minds of the people who will lead the next generation. Unable to withstand the force of the Enlightenment, the church absorbed the philosophy and ideas of the day. And I would argue, thanks in part to the skepticism of David Hume and the philosophy of Immanuel Kant, who provided the philosophical grounding for the separation of faith and reason, we now find ourselves with an intellectually bankrupt Christianity in a modern era that is centered around me, myself, and I. Just listen to a lot of modern worship. It's all about me. Contrast the nature of the content of it. And I'm not critiquing the means now, because whether it's done with organs or without organs, the medium is different. Consider the content, the theological content of old hymns in light of modern contemporary worship. You see how shallow so much of the modern stuff is. It talks about me, 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 me. As if you're the most interesting thing in the world. Well, I'm sorry to burst your bubble, you're not. It's not about you, really. It's about whom? It's about the Lord. Some believe that Kant helped rescue Christianity from the critics. He offered a philosophy which would entitle a Christian to his faith so long as it had nothing to do with reason. Immanuel Kant, this little German, has had more effect on Western civilization than you would even begin to realize. This notion of what's true for you is true for you and what's true for me, where does that come from? It comes from his philosophy. Because he doesn't think that we have access to things and experience in the way that we typically think we do. Because when I look at the microphone, I see the microphone as it appears to me. And this gentleman looks at the microphone and he sees the microphone as it appears to him. And so he has a concept, he has this microphone in his head as he's thinking about it, and I have, and so what's true for me is true for me, and what's true for this guy is true for that guy. You see how it works? And then it follows from that. That's his philosophy. There's nothing objective outside there that's true. Everything becomes conditional upon my own perspective. These ideas were absorbed by the church because they failed to do philosophy to combat that. Because how you combat philosophy is not to abandon philosophy. You combat bad philosophy with good philosophy. And with this led to a theology which renounces the role of reason in the faith. Theology had always had God at the center during the 1800s or earlier on. Theology always had God at the center of the study of theology. But in the 1800s, you find this shift where theology moves from God being at the center to anthropology. It's out of this philosophy that anthropology is birthed. And since we cannot know God, okay, because we have no access to him because he's not a physical thing, what do we study? We study cultures and men's religious experience. There comes anthropology. Go to your classes at your universities. And what are your kids when they go in the classes? What are they going to study? That's what they're going to study. Thanks in part to the philosophy coming out of the 1800s. So theology, the study of God, have effectively become anthropology, the study of man. So Christianity retracted from defending the faith, for it failed to offer a response to the philosophers like Immanuel Kant. And sadly, the church did not escape and absorb this philosophy, which is grounded upon assumptions that undermine our faith. Sadly, this continues to be the case at most seminaries and Bible colleges who are oblivious or ignorant of the philosophies which undergird their studies. Unfortunately, there are many pious theologians who educate many of our pastors and think that philosophy is not important. It's a vain enterprise. What these men are not realizing is philosophy is the handmaiden to theology. Logic is a discipline of philosophy. Try and do theology without logic. Good luck on you, mate. Theology, logic is how we think. Logic examines the way that we think. Everybody who reads the Bible does so employing logic. Logic is a discipline of philosophy. Why aren't we teaching logic in our seminaries and Bible colleges? Go and look around at the programs and ask yourself that question. C.S. Lewis said, he said this, philosophy must be practiced if for no other reason because bad philosophy needs to be answered. C.S. Lewis understood the importance of philosophy. I wish that many of our professors would pay attention to what the man said. Everyone is a philosopher at some level. The moment you start to think about things, the nature of truth, the nature of man, the nature of reality, questions concerning morality and government, the nature of beauty and music and art, language, the nature of God, you're starting to do philosophy at some level. And so we have this choice. Either we do good philosophy or bad philosophy. Well, do you think that Romans chapter 12, verse 2 has anything to do with this? What is the transformation of the Christian mind? Just thinking good thoughts about baby Jesus in a manger? I would submit to you that the transformation of the Christian mind is as radical as the transformation of the Christian heart. And when I went to Speaker's Corner, why was I going there? So God could show me my own ignorance. That I might be pressed into realizing that I had a feeble, facile mind. I had a heart, a big heart like Secretariat, this big pulsing heart for Jesus, but I had a diseased mind, not able to think. I couldn't distinguish between an argument and an opinion. This was an uncomfortable process for me, this process of self-diagnosis. When I began to sat down and began to think about my views, because I realized I've got a heart for Jesus, but I think like a secularist. And this was exposed when I was confronted on my position on abortion. Because I had reasoned, well, you know, usually in the instance of abortion, the guy who's responsible is usually worthless and he's usually a hopeless affair. And so, you know, the woman has to carry the child for 9 months. And so if anybody should be the person who decides, well then, nobody should tell her. She should really have the right to decide what happens to the child. That's how I thought as a Christian. And I can guarantee you that millions of Christians in this country think exactly like that. And then somebody challenged me with an argument and said, look, that's unchristian and here's the reason why. And then I had this crisis moment where I realized, my goodness me, I've got a secular mind. I'm a pragmatist, and I didn't even realize it. This is what was happening to me. I was a pragmatist without even knowing it. Well, what is a pragmatist? A person who decides that something is right based on whether it works or not, solves problems. We don't want unwanted children and mothers with unwanted children, so what do? You decide what happens to the children. Pragmatism is a philosophy that came to us thanks in part to whom? The Americans. You're the greatest pragmatist on the planet. And materialism is the stepchild of pragmatism. And if ever there's an evil that's ruining this country, it's your crazy desire for stuff, man. Stuff, stuff, stuff. Look at Walmart. Stop. It's crazy. Many people are unloved and unwanted. This is a problem. But does this give us license to exterminate them? No. So what is it inside a mother? A puppy? A parrot? No, it's a child. And we carve them up every day by the thousands and then convince ourselves that this is not the murder of an innocent person. The right to life, it would seem, only applies to you when you pass the birth canal. And so here's the mind-numbing contradiction of this crazy idea. In one room, in one hospital, doctors and parents are intentionally to do everything they can do to rescue a child inside the womb. You know, nowadays they can operate in utero. They can stick all these things inside there and work on the baby. And in the other room, what are the doctors doing? They're carving the baby up. That's insane. And then society stands by and applauds us as a great act of freedom while we're doing wonderful things, you know. How is intentionally taking the life of an innocent person not murder? Think about that. Use your mind, because your heart isn't going to help you on this question right now. Your heart's going to make you, your heart's going to do what it's doing to me now. It's going to start getting you motivated to do something. But you better have the right ideas first. Because your passions need to come alongside what is true. In generations past, we call people who sacrifice babies barbarians. And by comparison, we make these barbarians look like a bunch of saints. For we sacrifice children by the millions in the name of the God of free choice and convenience. It's nothing less than last-ditch contraception. That's what it is. In the last 30 years, I think that there have been over 40 million abortions in the United States. You think God is going to let this slide? This is why the truth and making philosophical distinctions is very important. For those who are pro-choice are obligated to begin to play their little games of sophistry and metaphor and truth about what the nature of the baby is inside the mother's room. And so when you say, well, it's a person, they say, well, it depends what you mean by person. Because if it's a person, then it's murder. So they have to say what? That the fetus is not a person. That's when the whole discussion begins. But if you can't think about things and listen to their arguments and call out where it's failing, saying, no, 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 hang on a sec now. You're equivocating now. That's not true and you know it. How can we engage the culture that's slaughtering children by the thousands? Unless you are able to think carefully, how are you as a Christian going to point out why these arguments fail? If you think for a moment that you think like a Christian, think about this example. It's a little bit more subtle. But this is another thing that came across my table when I realized. When speaking of things that are beautiful, people often say this. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Have you heard that before? Well, if you believe this concerning beauty, then you have an anti-Christian view of beauty. Interestingly, this statement is in direct agreement with whom? David Hume. David Hume said this. Beauty is no quality in things themselves. It exists merely in the mind which contemplates it. So something's beautiful only because I'm contemplating it. There's no objective beauty to something. But beauty is not in the eye of the beholder, despite the protests of the modern artists. Stuffing a plastic pipe full of cabbages and sticking it in the Tate Gallery doesn't make it a piece of art. And I don't care what they say. Postmodern art is just, most of it is just garbage. And it is actually garbage. They can't make a distinction between rotting cabbages and the Sistine Chapel. Well, who has the problem there? Location, as with the question concerning abortion, doesn't change the nature of a thing. A baby is no less a baby because it's on this side of the birth canal. A child is no less a person simply because it has passed the birth canal. If beauty is relative, then my little scrawls on my pager are more beautiful than the Sistine Chapel. And Michelangelo is no more of an artist than Simon Brace, which is false. Beauty is objective. So my challenge to you is, Christian, to whom does your mind belong? Are you attending to your mind? Are you thinking about these things? Many Christian schools fail to teach philosophy and then wonder why it is that their students have difficulty reaching this generation. But when you fail to understand how ideas have consequences, you will not only fail to reach your generation, but then you will also put those whom you're teaching at great peril because you haven't taught them how to think. And then we fail to study the ideas and that discipline which deals with ideas, which is philosophy. That's why I'm so grateful for Southern Evangelical Seminary. Why? Because we integrate theological studies and logic and critical thinking into our theology departments and our Bible departments. Because we want to understand the ideas that drive the skeptic. In failing to attend to the Christian mind, Christians have handed over all, just about all of the academic institutions to the secularists. I believe that the first 150 universities in this country, including all of the Ivy League schools which are in this area, were started as Bible colleges. And most of these institutions are distinctively anti-Christian today. How did that happen? How did we build these great universities and now we've lost them? We're now stuck with what? A homeschooling program. Now, I'm not dissing homeschooling. I'm going to homeschool myself. But that's because we've lost the universities. And our schools are going in the same direction. Because we've got nothing reasonable to say in those institutions about the Christian faith. So if you don't think you should be investing in academics and teaching young people to study theology and philosophy in this, you're wrong. You need to support. Because in this crowd here, there's going to be some young people here who are gifted thinkers. And you need to invest in them and their academic studies so that they can become defenders of the faith. And we can go back to these universities and the Yales of the school and the Harvards and the Princetons and get back on campus and say, let me remind you how this school began. By Christians. The retreat from academia has served to provide an arena into which we now march our youth, who in turn have their faith shipwrecked by these professors, and then we stand around like a bunch of fools wondering what happened. Well, how did that happen? What is that? That's a reflection of how poorly we're thinking and failing to do anything about it. God is the foundation of reason. Reason exists because of Him. When we speak of God, we should be making reasonable statements about Him. When we speak to somebody about Christianity, we're not making an irrational appeal. It is reasonable to believe that God exists, and there's plenty of evidence to support that. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Think about that. I think it's radical, man. I think it is such... And so many people who preach on that verse just wash over it. This is a radical overhaul of the way that you think. The mind is important because it is not only with the mind that we should think good thoughts about God, but it is with the mind which we are able to apprehend the truth and ferret out false things. Contemplation of God, who is the creator of reality, should transform our minds. God is also concerned that we are not deceived concerning the truth. God expects you to exercise your mind. And I say this to so many American youth groups that I speak to. There is no glory in being an idiot for Jesus. So stop it. Use your mind to glorify God to the best of your capacity. If you don't, it's a form of lethargy, slothfulness. It's intellectual slothfulness. Laziness doesn't just apply because, oh, I don't want to go take the trash out or mow the yard. You can have intellectual laziness because you don't want to have to read and study. And that begins, let me let you know, first of all, with studying this thing. It's hard work. So we have to use our minds. It's a way that we worship God. God honors that. Well, this brings us now to 1 Peter 3:15, which says what? Always be prepared to give a reason for the hope that you have. But we do this with gentleness and respect. Where does the gentleness and respect come from? Well, because we want to be like Christ. But where should it also come from? From the confidence in knowing that Christianity is true. We do work with lots of atheists I've worked with many atheists. Some of them are really angry about their atheism. And they're cantankerous, and they're obnoxious, and they're crass, and they're vulgar. I'm not put out by that. What else should I expect from somebody who's without Jesus? We have to engage these people. Why? Because I was once there, man. And we have something true and reasonable to say to them. The church has been practicing apologetics, but in recent centuries, it has abandoned this discipline. And this is why we're struggling to win the culture back, because there's no defenders of the faith. Titus 1:9 is an injunction that is given to elders. What distinguishes an elder from a deacon? The chief distinction between the two people in the office of the church is the capacity to teach, as I understand. And in Titus 1:9, Paul gets very specific. He says, not only is it expected of an elder that he should be able to preach and teach the gospel, which is very important, what is the second thing that he can do? Refute those who oppose. How many MDiv graduates coming out of all of the best conservative theological institutions in this country can defend the faith? I would ask that question of Albert Mohler, Paige Patterson, and anybody else who walked in here and happened to be a president. Are you graduating your MDiv students, because we assume that those guys are going to become leaders and elders in the church, to be able to defend the faith as well and give great expository sermons? Because there's no use preaching a great exegetical sermon to a bunch of postmodern people who don't believe in absolute truth. Because they might just go, well, that's just true for you. Can you see how this is working, folks? This is very significant. One of the reasons why people don't like apologetics is because they say, well, I don't like to argue with people. We just love people. That sounds so pious. It's pious nonsense. Jesus is arguing with people all the time. Go and read the New Testament. This book is an argument from God against man's ideas. It's an argument. It's go this way, not that way, and don't go that way, and here's the reasons why. Yes, I admit that at times we might not be able to give an argument verbally. Our lives should be an argument for the Lord, but people sometimes have that as an excuse for failing to actually preach the gospel and defend the faith and present arguments for the faith. Paul is arguing with people all the time. Go and read the New Testament. What is he doing in Acts chapter 17? He reasons with the Jews from the Scriptures. Well, why would he reason with the Jews from the Scriptures? Because the Jews have the Old Testament, and the Jews speaks of whom? The Old Testament speaks of whom? Jesus Christ. Then he goes and he speaks to the Greeks and the Stoic Epicure. What does he not do? He doesn't reason with the Greeks from the Scriptures. Why? Because they wouldn't have given any authority to this thing. But it doesn't leave him hamstrung, because there's many doors to a room that God has provided for us to get into. And so he gauges them on their religion. And he makes a case for the Christian faith. And we see this, the same thing in Acts chapter 26 in his defense before Festus and Agrippa. He's appealing to the historical evidences of the death and resurrection of Jesus. Christianity cannot avoid argumentation. The moment you're going to try and bring truth to people, you are going to be at odds with them, and there's an argument going on. Our life should be an argument for Christ, but we should also be prepared to give a reason for the hope that we have. Consider 2 Corinthians 10, verse 5, perhaps the strongest verse which speaks to this. It says, "We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought and make it obedient to Christ." Spiritual warfare is first and foremost an ideological battle. It's a battle of ideas. And if you can't think well, how can you engage in that spiritual warfare? Because we don't fight with weapons like the U.S. military does. And that's what we expect them to do. Christians, we don't fight like that. We don't force people with weapons and bombs and propaganda. We present the gospel, we make a case for the faith as persuasively as we can. And when we see a bad philosophy, we say that philosophy fails, and here's the reason why. We take captive that idea and we bring it, make it obedient to Christ. Bible says do not have anything to do with foolish and stupid arguments, because you know that they produce quarrels. You'll get this thrown at you as well. Yes, but what the Bible is doing is it says you need to make a distinction between having an argument with a fool and a non-fool. Because sometimes some people, you just don't need to be talking to them. But wisdom demands, or should come along where you know, look, I'm wasting my time with this individual. But some people are looking. They're looking for a reason. They want to raise a question. And so you have to engage them. All right. So hopefully I've done enough to persuade you this morning that the Christian faith entails the radical overhaul of the Christian mind. And here's one of the coolest things about Romans chapter 12, verse 2. Okay? Who wants to know what the will of God in your life is? Raise your hands. Okay? Every Christian wants to know that. We all wrestle. I can tell you, evangelicals have written gobs of ink has been spilt, oceans of ink, on books trying to answer this question. Here's a radical thought. Go back to that verse. Let's read it carefully again, because this changed my life significantly. Because the question we want to ask is, what is the transformation of the Christian mind? But look what Paul says in Romans chapter 12, verse 2. He says, look, do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And then he says something most interesting. He says, then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. Apparently, the transformation of the mind has something to do with you discovering what the will of God is in your life. Now, isn't that interesting? Because the question is, what does that look like? That's a fascinating verse, isn't it? Something about the radical overhaul of your mind will help you, lead you to discover what God's will is in your life. Think about that. Because we've got a lot of young people, they're crying out for the will of God, and they just got all of these bizarre things that they've been... And I'm saying, look, learn to love God with your heart and mind. And apparently when you do that, you'll discover His will. You don't need to read all of this garbage out there. The Scripture says it in a very important place in Romans 12 where the transition is happening. So I'm going to close with these two verses. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13. Listen carefully to what these verses say. It says, therefore, prepare your minds for action. Be self-controlled. Set your hope fully on the grace to be given you when Jesus Christ is revealed. Colossians 4:4 says, pray that I may proclaim it as clearly as I should. Be wise in the way you act towards outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. There's my challenge for you this morning, brothers and sisters, that we think carefully about the condition of the Christian mind. That you ask yourself this question, to whom does your mind belong? And that it's not enough just to have big hearts for Jesus. We should have minds that match our hearts. We can't go around thinking that diseased and feeble minds are a good thing for the Lord. And I encourage all of you to embark on that journey now of committing your lives to studying and reading and learning. It's hard work, and it's best done in groups. And I'm excited that this church has obviously got in place people who are seeing this. That's why they've invited us to help get together and study. And even here, I can tell a lot about a church from the books that it has. There's some excellent books on that table right out there. I can encourage you to go and read those books out there. Every single one of the books that I saw on that table is a good one. I encourage you to go and read that. It'll radically transform your life. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to close in the word of prayer. See, my mind is failing me now. I forgot to remember something. So let me just close in the word of prayer then. Lord, I just thank you for this opportunity, Lord, and I pray that you've used my musings and my efforts for something greater than I could possibly conceive, Lord. I thank you, first and foremost, Lord, for how you have just changed my life through all of these things, Lord. Shown me what an ignorant man I was and continue to be, but at the same time, you are teaching me something and you're moving me on, Lord, and for that I'm very grateful. And I pray, Lord, that everybody in this audience would learn to discover what it means to love you with both their hearts and their minds. First, for their own sake, that they might get to understand how awesome you are, how amazing your creation is, and your word, how rich and thick and full it is of truth and everything we need for this life. But then to equip us to go out into this world and to speak to the non-Christians persuasively. To make a persuasive case for the Christian faith. We thank you for your word. We thank you for your creation. And we thank you for Jesus Christ and what he's done for us. In his name, amen.
Staying with us.